This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. Here is what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
With increased warming, we expect a reduction in terms of food production. We also expect impacts in terms of disease and pests. But importantly, we will have impacts generated by flooding on the infrastructure system for agriculture production.
That was Felipe Lucchea, the World Meteorological Organization Director of Regional Strategic Office, on the impact on Africa if the global climate continues its warming trend. Details coming up also. Sudan has become the third state to move towards normalizing relations with Israel. And U.S. lawmakers, activists say Nigerian protests are part of a global human rights issue. All these and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. But first, our top story. The World Meteorological Organization is calling for urgent action to mitigate the impact of climate change in Africa, which threatens food security, health, and socio-economic development on the continent. WMO has just launched a multi-agency publication, The State of the Climate in Africa 2019. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
The report presents a bleak snapshot of current and future climate trends in Africa brought on by an inexorable rise in warming. Since 1901, it notes Africa has warmed by more than 1 degree Celsius, with 2019 among the three warmest years on record. The World Meteorological Organization warns Africa faces many challenges brought on by climate variability, extreme weather events, and sea level rise. A case in point is Tropical Cyclone Idai, which struck Mozambique in 2019. Idai, one of the most destructive tropical cyclones ever recorded in the Southern Hemisphere, caused more than 700 deaths, widespread loss of homes, livelihoods, and displacement. The Food and Agriculture Organization reports the number of undernourished people in drought-prone sub-Saharan African countries has increased by 45.6% since 2012. WMO Director of Regional Strategic Office Felipe Lucchio tells VOA many people are likely to go hungry as a result of climate variability and change.
With increased warming, we expect a reduction in terms of food production. We also expect impacts in terms of disease and pests. But importantly, we will have impacts generated by flooding on the infrastructure system for agriculture production, which is the main source of livelihoods and food security in the continent.
The report notes new diseases are emerging in regions where they had not been seen before because of rising temperatures and changes in rainfall patterns. For example, malaria epidemics have occurred in the higher altitudes of East African highlands, where mosquitoes previously were unable to survive. The economic impact on the continent is also great. WMO climate coordinator Omar Badour says the gross domestic product in five African sub-regions is expected to decrease by 2.25% to 12.12% as a result of global temperature increase.
It leads to a jobless situation and less economic activity, employment and immigration and so conflicts. So it's really an alarming indicator that we can see as an impact on the African continent.
WMO urges African governments to increase their climate risk management strategies. These involve improving preparedness, prevention, and early warning systems based on good data and weather forecasting. It says Africa should employ techniques such as efficient and clean energy sources. It says solar-powered, efficient micro-irrigation, for example, improves agricultural yields by up to 300%, and reduces water usage by up to 90%, this while offsetting carbon emissions. WMO says these techniques have been shown to increase farm-level incomes by 5 to 10 times where they've been employed. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
As the protests demanding police reforms continue in Nigeria, observers say the U.S. and the international community have a role to play. VOA's Salem Salomon has the story.
American politicians and civil rights leaders are lending their voices to the protests in Nigeria against abuses by the Special Anti-Robbery Squad, or SARS, a police unit accused of excessive violence against civilians. Representative Sheila Jackson Lee, a Texas Democrat, wrote a letter along with the Congressional Black Caucus to Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari, urging him to reform the security sector and allow people to demonstrate peacefully.
What is happening now with SARS? And the peaceful protest of Nigerians that has been responded to by bloodshed and violence is unacceptable.
She also wrote a letter to the U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and to the United Nations, saying the U.S. must call for a special meeting of the U.N. Security Council to investigate human rights abuses. Jackson Lee's congressional district is home to the largest concentration of Nigerian Americans in the country.
We want the United States to take a firm stand with President Buhari against this violence and to recognize that people who protest have a right to do so without violence. And they particularly have a right to be able to utilize their streets in free expression of their voice.
The SARS protests began this month following the release of a video showing officers killing a man who was dragged out of a hotel. Nigerians began sharing other videos showing abuse and extrajudicial killings, leading to growing outrage and widespread demonstrations. The Nigerian government announced the dissolution of the unit, but protests have continued, and recently security forces opened fire on protesters in Lagos's Lekki Toll Gate Plaza, killing at least 12 people, according to Amnesty International. Opal Temeti, an American human rights activist and co-founder of the Black Lives Matter movement, has particularly close connection to the protests since her parents are Nigerian. She sees parallels between what is happening there and the BLM movement that swept the U.S.
Those types of injustices that are taking place in Nigeria are also linked to the struggles that we have in different parts of the world. We are united for a just Nigeria. We are united in an end to this police brutality and an end to the extrajudicial killing of its Nigerian citizens.
Temeti has been in regular contact with friends and family in the country and said virtually everyone has a story to tell about abusive or frightening encounters with the police. The recent incidents have simply been a tipping point that galvanized the community to act, she said.
And I think what we're seeing now is a courageous movement that has risen up, that has said enough is enough. They're tired, especially in the midst of this time where we are in a global pandemic. People are already living on the brink.
Jackson Lee has heard similar stories from her constituents. She recently marched with them at the Mickey Leland Federal Building in Houston and invited them to her district office to share their concerns.
They had a video showing the outright shooting by military persons that would really break your heart, because you know that unarmed persons lost their life that night, someone's young son or daughter.
She said Nigerian Americans are fearful of worsening violence that could spiral out of control.
They don't want their country to turn into a quagmire of civil war or a quagmire of a dictatorial type government that uses the military to brutalize its citizens. They want the Nigeria that they love, and they want the Nigeria that has the capacity to be a democratic, free, safe, and nonviolent community.
Rights groups said they have documented extensive abuse during the crackdowns against protesters. Adote Akwe is the managing director for government relations at Amnesty International USA. He told VOA that there is evidence that actions by security forces had been planned. Amnesty International also said at least 56 people have been killed over the past 2 weeks in protests.
In Alawasa, we found that there was credible evidence that there was efforts to shut off short-circuit TV that would have monitored how the police behaved, which indicates that they were planning a very brutal crackdown, and that's unfortunately what happened.
He urged the Nigerian government to exercise restraint.
So we continue to stick with the calls for the Nigerian government to respect the right to nonviolent protest, respect the individual rights of the protesters, for the protesters who've been arrested to be released, and also, of course, for the Nigerian government to engage in genuine, comprehensive security sector reform and accountability for the SARS unit members.
Salem Solomon, VOA News, Washington.
Sudan has become the third state to move towards normalizing relations with Israel. But unlike Israel's recent deal with Abu Dhabi, where hotels are already promoting packages for Israeli tourists, the deal with Sudan still faces several hurdles, including some public opposition. Linda Gratstein reports from Jerusalem.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu announced the normalization deal with Sudan. Netanyahu called it a dramatic breakthrough to peace and said the famous three no's from Sudan in 1967, no peace with Israel, no to negotiations with Israel, and no to normalization with Israel, turned into three yeses. Sudan had rejected Israel's occupation of the West Bank and Gaza and said Israel must withdraw from all of those areas to make a Palestinian state. Sudan follows the United Arab Emirates and Bahrain in making deals with Israel. Sudan follows the United Arab Emirates and Bahrain into making deals with Israel, with U.S. President Donald Trump saying at least five more are on the way, with Israel hoping that Saudi Arabia, with its huge economy and oil reserves, is one of them. In Sudan, the situation is a little more complicated. Many Sudanese oppose the normalization of ties with Israel, with demonstrators burning Israeli flags on the streets of Khartoum. Sudan is also in the process of transitioning from a dictatorship to a democracy. Foreign Minister Omar Gamal al-Din said that a peace deal with Israel would have to be ratified by a legislative council, a body which does not yet exist. It is not clear when the council will be formed. For Israel, normalization with Sudan would have important military benefits, says former Israeli ambassador to Washington, Michael Oren.
The vast majority of rockets that are fired at us from Gaza are not made in Gaza, they're made in Iran. And they get into Gaza via the Sudan. And the Sudanese relationship, our peace relationship with Sudan, would have an immediate impact in stemming the flow of Iran, made in Iran missiles into the Gaza Strip. I assume that if missiles are getting in, money's getting in, other things are getting in, it'll be very difficult now for Hamas and Islamic Jihad to import Iranian weapons and other materials through the Sudan. And that would be extremely important to us.
The Palestinians have condemned the Arab outreach to Israel as a new stab in the back for them. As part of the deal, Washington also agreed to take Sudan off the list of organizations that support state terrorism. Linda Gradstein for VOA News, Jerusalem.
Egypt held the first round of elections for its lower chamber of parliament Saturday in 14 of the country's 27 provinces. The second round is due to be held in the rest of the country early next month, with final results expected in December. Edward Yerenian reports from Cairo.
Voters turned out Saturday to cast their ballots in 14 of Egypt's 27 provinces, including the historic port city of Alexandria and Cairo's sister province of Giza. Voter turnout was mixed, with Egyptian media reporting lines at some polling stations and a light turnout at others. Egyptian media broadcast video of public figures, including Prime Minister Mustafa Madbouly, casting ballots at polling stations near their homes. Police and military were posted outside to prevent possible acts of terrorism, and voters were given masks to prevent the spread of COVID-19. 63 million Egyptians are eligible to vote in both rounds of the election, and officials reminded voters that they could face a $30 fine if they do not cast their ballots. In practice, however, fines are rarely imposed on those who do not vote. Saeed Sadiq, who teaches political sociology in Cairo, says the Egyptian public appears to be looking for stability
amid regional turbulence and after the tumult of two revolutions which shook the country in 2011 and 2013.
The people want regular, slow, stable reform rather than unplanned, directionless revolution and revolt. And of course, you find the regional enemies are promoting instability in Egypt and calling for revolts and sabotage and let's overthrow the government.
Sadiq adds that Egyptians have tried this road before and ended up in a miserable situation. He argues that most Egyptians don't want to go back to the time of the revolution of 2011. Paul Sullivan, who is a professor at the U.S. National Defense University, says it is important that people have a voice. He says that his long experience with Egyptians from various economic, social, political, and cultural backgrounds is that they are proud of their country and have a lot to say about where it is and where it should be going. 4,000 candidates are running for 50% of the eligible seats in the 568-seat chamber, while slightly over 1,100 candidates are vying for the other half of the chamber, which is being elected by party list. Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi will also appoint members to an extra 28 seats. A number of foreign and Egyptian NGOs are acting as election monitors. The now-outlawed Muslim Brotherhood, which was toppled by a popular revolution supported by the military in 2013, is not allowed to run any candidates, but continues to have an active media arm in both Qatar and Turkey, which oppose the government. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
U.S. lawmakers have urged Egyptian President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi to release detained activists, journalists, lawyers, and prisoners of conscience. About 55 U.S. lawmakers sent a letter a week ago to Egypt's leader asserting that he must release all those who had been unjustly detained for exercising their fundamental human rights. Lawmaker Jim McGovern, who is one of the Congress's members leading the cause, said, "The unjust detention of Egyptian human rights defenders, peaceful political activists, and other prisoners of conscience is in direct opposition to the rights and freedoms enshrined in Egyptian and American law." VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawi discussed these developments with Seth Binder, the advocacy officer at Project on Middle East Democracy.
I think it first got prompted having to do with the protests on the one-year anniversary of September 20th. Small protests throughout the country, but led to mass arrests. And I think this is sort of building upon something you've seen, particularly within Congress. There was a hearing that took place not long ago in the House Foreign Affairs Committee, where they also were quite critical of expressing very similar concerns about human rights abuses, political detainees. And I think what you've seen is, unfortunately, since Sisi has taken power, you've seen only the, not a roller coaster of repression, but really more of an escalator. There might be times where it sort of levels out, but it never decreases. It just keeps continuing to increase. And I think Democrats in Congress are getting to that tipping point where they can no longer just sit idly by.
In the letter to President al-Sisi, the U.S. lawmakers stated that the lives of those imprisoned unjustly was endangered due to the large outbreaks of COVID-19 in the country's prisons, and that dangers are compounded by the fact that Egypt's prisons are grossly overcrowded. What was the Egyptian government response to the letter, which coincided with a similar request from the European Union?
It's my understanding that the Egyptians have not responded, but I think it can't be understated that the significance of the threat. There have been documentation about the spread of COVID within prisons, and we already know there's long been documentation about the poor conditions within prisons, the poor medical care provided, and so forth. And so the threat is significant, and folks have already died in prisons. You know, just one example, the journalist Mohamed Mounir, who died while in pretrial detention. And ultimately, hopefully this letter led by Representatives Khanna, McGovern, and Senator Brown, hopefully this is sending an important message to the Egyptians. And I think they're got to be concerned about how they're seeing the current upcoming election in the U.S., what polling looks like. They've got to be concerned that, you know, here are Democrats expressing legitimate and significant concerns. And this might be what Egyptians need to address and what a Biden administration and what a Democratic Congress might look like.
Recently, as you said, there was a hearing in Congress regarding human rights violations in Egypt, where experts recommended suspension of some U.S. aid to Egypt over those violations, but the administration didn't do that. What such a letter would achieve if the U.S. administration is not using its leverage?
Unfortunately, this administration has cozied up to Sisi. You know, he famously called him his favorite dictator. And Congress has spoken out in the hearing, in these letters. But I think ultimately it might take that next step. And Congress has the power to do that. They have the power of the purse. We provide a lot of military aid to the Egyptians year in and year out. And it, in order to sort of carry through with these concerns, conditioning that aid will almost certainly be necessary. Determining and laying out clearly to the Egyptians, here are our concerns and here's what we're going to condition this aid on. And unless you address these concerns, we're going to reduce or we're going to cut the amount of aid we're providing.
Lawmaker Jim McGovern, who is one of the U.S. Congress members leading the cause, said the unjust detention of Egyptian human rights defenders, peaceful political activists, and other prisoners of conscience is in direct opposition to the rights and freedoms enshrined in both Egyptian and American laws. In practical terms, what could the U.S. Congress do to secure the release of prisoners of conscience in Egypt?
The first part of this is there's a devastating numbers of prisoners of conscience. I think the letter identifies some of the largest ones, Ali Abdel Fattah, Esra Abdel Fattah, Sana Saif, Rami Shah, and on and on. And I think we can't forget their names. We need to keep repeating them. But there's so many that we don't talk about it. And it's devastating to sort of think about the numbers that are in prisons. And I think the response needs to be from Congress that they're willing to condition the aid, that they're willing to remove any sort of national security waiver that's been put on the aid. We've seen in both Democratic and Republican administrations that when there is this waiver, they use it. And Congress needs to take some of that power back, not include a waiver, and force the Egyptians to address Congress's concerns.
That was Seth Binder, the advocacy office at Project on Middle East Democracy, speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi. Mali's interim prime minister has expressed willingness to talk with Islamist militants, while former colonial power France ruled out the prospect. Mokhtar Ouane, who was appointed interim prime minister last month to manage an 18-month transition after a military coup August 18th, says his government is prepared to pursue talks. But French Foreign Minister Jean-Yves Le Drian, on a trip to Mali, ruled out such dialogue with jihadists driving an 8-year-old insurgency in the Sahel state. Malian officials have provided few specifics about what kinds of compromises could emerge, but some proponents of negotiations have said they could include recognition of a greater role for Islam in public life. And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.
Sports fans, this is the Voice of America's Sonny Young. Please join me Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC for the sunny side of sports. On Fridays, you can also hear my expanded 30-minute edition of the show at 1730 UTC, right here on the English to Africa service of the Voice of America.